mortgages, even the energy to heat their houses. Those losing their jobs are at a serious risk of becoming immediately homeless.
Sanctions against Russia are hurting the EU's economy. This as huge sums are spent on the war in Ukraine. Unlike EU decision makers, it seems a growing number of citizens want peace talks.
The solution is there. The solution is not to rearm Europe.
If France or Belgium had the war and Ukraine had this huge money, are we thinking that they're gonna give us this money? I don't believe so.
Meanwhile, the cash keeps flowing out of the EU and into Ukraine. Since things escalated in February last year, the EU has spent 83 billion euro on arming Ukraine, propping up the government in Kiev, and housing Ukrainian refugees. Some legislators claim it's a war the EU simply cannot afford or win. The European Central Bank has now increased interest rates 10 times in a row. The strategy, aimed at reducing inflation, is being questioned.
Inflation is the enemy of the poor and those on low incomes. But equally, high interest rates causes recessions, and recessions bring about unemployment.
Analysts point out that those driving the EU's economic and foreign policies are well able to afford the consequences, unlike the average person. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In Paris, protesters gathered to express their support for Palestine's unprecedented and successful surprise military operation against Israel. By land, air, and sea, and with missiles, drones, and even manned hang gliders, the Palestinian resistance sent illegal settlers fleeing, captured Israeli soldiers, and apprehended Israeli military equipment, provoking awe in longtime pro-Palestinian activists.
We're all witnessing incredible actions by the Palestinian armed resistance, who, as far as we know, managed to come out of this huge concentration camp that Gaza is and inflict severe losses to the Israeli soldiers and settlers. We're looking at the news every minute.
The reasons for the offensive seem to be too many to count. This year has already seen a record annual number of West Bank children murdered, Israel wages 10 police raids every day, and Tel Aviv recently approved thousands of more illegal settlements, which one Palestinian official said was a declaration of open war against the Palestinian people. Last year, Israeli murders of West Bank Palestinians reached their highest level since 2005. While Israel's blockade of Gaza since 2007 is routinely labeled a crime against humanity. Israel's horrific crimes against Palestinians go back many, many decades, but so does the collaboration in these crimes by Western governments who often claim to defend human rights.
Today, we are, of course, going to congratulate the Palestinian resistance and to expose the complicity of our government, to start with the French government, who is never stop collaborating with Israel occupation and colonization, because nobody says it, but it's not two armies, one against the other. It's people that are occupied and people that are occupying.
More protests in support of Palestinians are expected, but in 2014, France infamously became the first country in the world to ban pro-Palestinian demonstrations. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Over the past year and a half, the DPRK has launched more missiles than ever before. The U.S. has tried to deter that testing with initiating and expanding more sanctions against Pyongyang. On Wednesday, a key expert on the peninsula's issues told U.S. senators that Washington should now threaten the DPRK with preemptive strikes.
One of the ideas there, and it's a risky one,
is declaratory policy, to say that we reserve the right to actually take down a missile if it's headed over Japan or if it's headed towards Hawaii or the west coast of the United States. And that could be a mid-course intercept, or it could be on the launch pad.
As the U.S. and South Korea have boosted military cooperation and weapons deployment, the DPRK has been developing its advanced capabilities, including testing ballistic, cruise, hypersonic, and submarine-launched missiles. Activists say the threat of preemptive attack will not deter Pyongyang.
The U.S. threat of a preemptive strike against North Korea does not dissuade North Korea from developing nuclear weapons, but rather, paradoxically, this has been a factor that further encourages North Korea's nuclear development.
Activists suggest that suspending sanctions and negotiating with North Korea is the only way to reduce tensions on the Korean Peninsula. While the U.S. seems intent on restraining the DPRK's missile development by any means, it pursues a different policy towards South Korea. In May of 2021, the U.S. agreed to lift all missile restrictions on South Korea, opening the way for Seoul to potentially produce its own long-range ICBMs. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In the limelight. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas, says no negotiations regarding Israeli captives will take place so long as Israel continues with its attacks on the besieged Gaza Strip. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered the story and tells us more. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas, says an ongoing operation against Israel will continue, while rejecting any negotiations on Israeli captives so long as the regime's attacks on the besieged Gaza Strip continue. Abu Obeida, the spokesman for the Gaza Strip-based movement's military wing, the Ezzedine al-Qassam Brigades, made the remark in a recorded message late on Monday, 9th of October, warning that the Israeli regime must be ready to pay a high price in exchange for the captives' freedom. The spokesman said, "The matter of prisoners is a strategically crucial issue with a well-defined trajectory, and the occupation will inevitably bear the consequences." Abu Obeida noted that the resistance fighters have succeeded in apprehending a significant number of the enemy's soldiers at various battlefronts, who have been relocated to Al-Qassam Brigade's detention facilities. Abu Obeida added, "We categorically refuse to engage in deliberations or negotiations regarding prisoner matters under the duress of aggression, and the enemy must prepare to pay the high price." Abu Obeida noted that Hamas has launched a military operation against Israel with unwavering resolve and courage, is fully aware of the potential outcomes, and is also prepared for any eventuality. Despite the enemy's possession of advanced security and military technology, they have failed to confront our fighters on the ground for over 60 hours now, the spokesman added. Abu Obeida emphasized that the resistance fighters will continue their large-scale operation across multiple locations with constant rotation of forces, the dispatch of reinforcements armed with weapons and equipment, and the capture of more prisoners. He said Hamas fighters have engaged in unrelenting clashes with Israeli forces, culminating in the defeat of the entire Gaza division of the Israeli occupation army on the first day of hostilities. He explained that Operation Al-Aqsa Storm came from the Zionist regime's repression of Palestinians, which had reached its peak through the desecration of the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The enemy thought that by closing the Al-Aqsa Mosque to our people and releasing herds of settlers to ignite a religious war, they would escape punishment for their crimes. He also criticized the international community and the United Nations for ignoring the Israeli regime's crimes, saying that large-scale operation against Israel was a response to the occupying regime's acts of aggression against innocent Palestinians. Abu Obeida warned the Israeli regime that the era of your triumphs have irrevocably ended, giving way to an era of defeat and setbacks. The Zadin al-Qassam brigades maintain a firm grip on the direction of the battle, underpinned by the efficient command and control system, and are fully prepared to endure for an extended period of time, Abu Obeida pointed out. Since Saturday, 7th of October, the Gaza Strip-based resistance group have fired thousands of rockets at the occupied Palestinian territories. On Monday, 9th of October, Hamas lauded the ongoing surprise attack against Israel as a legitimate right of Palestinians in response to the illegal entity's decades-long aggression and the silence of the international community. Hamas has praised the Operation Al-Aqsa Storm as legitimate Palestinian right to self-defense. Hamas made this statement on the third day of Operation Al-Aqsa Storm, the largest military operation against the Israeli regime in decades. The battle of Operation Al-Aqsa Storm is a legitimate right for our people to defend ourselves, to defend our land and our sanctities, in light of the continued aggression of the occupation forces and the silence and failure of the world to put an end to its escalating terrorism and its denial of all rights of the Palestinian people and their aspirations to liberate their homeland and achieve a return to our homeland, the movement said in a statement. CNN Cable News Network has also covered this story and tells us more. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas said late on Sunday, 8th of October, to be holding more than 100 hostages in Gaza, including high-ranking Israeli army officers, according to Musa Abu Marzouk, the deputy chief of Hamas's political bureau. Qatar has been in talks with Hamas about the hostages it holds inside Gaza, and the United States has been coordinating with the Qataris as they play a key mediating role with Hamas, a senior U.S. official confirmed to CNN. CNN has reached out to both the governments of Qatar and Israel for comment. Abu Obeida, the Zadin al-Qassam Brigade spokesperson, said Hamas will not negotiate on the issue of hostages whilst under Israeli fire. Israeli jets continued to bombard the Gaza Strip with deadly airstrikes on Monday, 9th of October, as the violence continued into a third day. The Zionist regime airstrikes have killed at least 687 Palestinians as of Monday, 9th of October, including dozens of Palestinian children and women, and left thousands injured, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. The Russian news agency TASS has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas says there will be no hostage negotiations as long as fighting continues. We will not negotiate on the issue of captives under fire from Israeli forces, the Hamas movement said in a statement. The Palestinian Hamas movement has announced that it does not intend to hold any negotiations on the fate of the hostages seized by its forces on Israeli territory near the Gaza Strip, while hostilities continue, according to the Al-Hadath television channel. Hamas representatives will not negotiate on the issue of captives under fire from Israeli forces, the movement said in a statement quoted by the Al-Hadath television channel.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Former head of Israel's Mossad spy agency has said the occupying entity enforces an apartheid system against Palestinians. The admission has been made by Tamir Pardo, who was the regime's spy master from 2011 to 2016.
Let's say there is a car accident between a car of a Jewish settler and a car of a Palestinian who lives in Hebron or Nablus. Each one of them stands before a different legal system, one under the military legal system and the other the civilian system. In a territory where two people are judged under two legal systems, that's an apartheid state.
Pardo becomes the latest former senior official to have concluded that Israel's treatment of Palestinians in the West Bank amounts to apartheid. That's a reference to the system of racial separation in South Africa that ended in 1994. Leading rights groups in Israel and abroad, as well as Palestinians, have accused Israeli occupation of the West Bank of morphing into an apartheid system. A handful of former Israeli leaders and diplomats have warned that Israel risks becoming an apartheid regime, but Pardo's language was even more blunt. Israel has been practicing an apartheid system against Palestinians, though far more brutally, since 1948. This is when, with the support of Western governments, Zionist terrorists claimed Palestine to be their homeland. Israel launched another war in 1967, occupying more Palestinian territory, such as the West Bank, including East al-Quds, that Palestinians want as the capital of their future state. Since then, Israeli apartheid authorities have created a judicial system that allows them to steal more Palestinian homes and land and dispossess them in order to make way for more illegal settlers. Rights groups have pointed to the discriminatory policies within Israel and in occupied East al-Quds, its blockade of the Gaza Strip, which has been ruled by the Hamas group since 2007, and its occupation of the West Bank.
Because the U.S. was the last pillar to fall, the last domino to fall in sustaining apartheid in South Africa, where it had to fall in line with everyone else. But during apartheid South Africa and the international campaign against it during that regime's tenure, the United States issued the most vetoes within the Security Council to protect apartheid there, to protect apartheid in Namibia and South Africa. And here we're seeing a similar pattern.
Rocket fire from Gaza. Palestinian fighters carrying out an unprecedented offensive with thousands of rockets. Sirens sounding across Israel, including Tel Aviv and Al-Quds. Israel is being attacked ferociously. This was by far the biggest operation by resistance groups against Israel in decades. We decided to put an end to all the crimes of the occupation. Their time for rampaging without being held accountable is over. We announced Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, and we fired in the first strike of 20 minutes, more than 5,000 rockets. That was the announcement by the Ezzedine Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of the Hamas resistance group. Armed clashes along the separation fence with Israel near the southern town of Khan Yunis were reported to take place. Fighters seen here breaking through the fence. The mood, however, was different. The head of Hamas's political bureau is seen celebrating the operation, carried out not only by Hamas fighters, but by all the resistance fighters in the Gaza Strip. Such was the case at the Jenin refugee camp. Israel has declared a state of war alert, striking back, setting the stage for a new heavy war. Hamas fighters are seen inside an Israeli military camp, which shows the shock surprise of Israeli army. Here, Hamas fighters are seen with a captured Israeli military vehicle.
This is a large operation including all Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank, namely Hamas, PFLP, the Ezzedine Al-Qassam Brigades, and the Islamic Jihad movements. In the occupied West Bank, the Lion's Den is also active. Israeli towns are on fire, like Rehovot in southern Israel, and Ashkelon seen burning after resistance rockets landed there. So dire the situation, Israelis were forced to hide in trash bins. Meanwhile, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are looking for cover, while sounding defiant when it comes to Israeli regime forces. Israel is finding itself on shaky grounds, even though it has mobilized reservists. There are shortages since reservists, along with pilots, have refused to take orders due to its so-called judicial reforms, which is why this announcement by Netanyahu may fall on deaf ears. Our enemy will pay a price, the type of which it has never known. That was a statement from Netanyahu. The surprise offensive that Palestinian fighters executed against the Israeli regime is a natural outcome of what Israel has done with Palestinians over the decades. Hezbollah summed it up best. This was a decisive response to Israel's continued occupation. However, Hezbollah also added this to its statement. This is a message to those seeking normalization with Israel. A clear reference to Saudi Arabia, which is said to be in talks with Israel for, quote, normalization. Ever since this extreme cabinet came into power, it has violated Palestinians on a daily basis. Not that previous Israeli officials did not do that, but this cabinet has done it at warp speed, which puts into question why Saudi Arabia would be interested in pursuing a, quote, normalization. Any normalization with Israel would be a stab in the back of Palestinians. Just the other day, Israel announced that it will legitimize the killing of Palestinian citizens in new open-fire rules. It said the new measure seeks to allow officers to use live fire against Palestinian protesters. Al-Aqsa violations, Israeli incursions, injuring and killing Palestinians. All of this in the face of the silence by the international community. How much longer could Palestinians endure this?
The war drags on in Ukraine, signs are emerging that do not bode well for the US-led coalition against Russia. Just days ago, the Slovak Social Democracy Party, which is a pro-Russia party, won the country's parliamentary elections. The leftist Smeristy Party, led by former Premier Robert Fico, has not secured enough votes to form a government and needs to form a coalition with other parties. But the victory has been interpreted as a sign of growing war fatigue in Europe. The party's leader has said that no more weapons would go to Ukraine. He has also questioned the logic of the EU's Russia sanctions and even accused NATO of causing the war.
I believe that on the one hand, yes, we should expect a certain, let's say, uncomfortable relationship between Brussels and Slovakia. But then on the other hand, I also think that the relationship will also be rather pragmatic. However, the danger is real when it comes to Slovakia's declining support to Ukraine. And this will also have its impact to weaken the EU's unity when it comes to its support for Ukraine.
Just weeks ago, Poland, a staunch ally of Ukraine, announced that it would no longer supply weapons to its neighbor amid a diplomatic dispute over Kiev's grain exports. Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki has said that Poland's focus was instead on defending itself with more modern weapons. The country's president later tried to modify their stance, but the dispute is seen as a rift among members of the anti-Moscow alliance. Poland has supplied hundreds of Soviet-era tanks and 14 MiG-29 fighter jets to Ukraine and served as a major transit hub for weapons from other Western nations. These developments have stirred talk of a global shift in sentiment towards supporting Ukraine as the war grinds on. more than a year and a half after it began.
It is full of Ukrainians here. This is what I seriously do not like. They get benefits, energy costs went up, everything went up. So basically, they are getting benefits, and we, our citizens, we pay.
The money spent on the war in Ukraine has unnerved many citizens in European countries. Days ago, hundreds of people staged rallies in different German cities to vent their anger at Berlin's growing support for Ukraine. Many protesters carried banners and placards advocating for peace in Ukraine while expressing opposition to government policies, including the remilitarization of Germany. Demonstrators said Germany's decision to send more weaponry to Ukraine risks escalation of the conflict with Russia. Some protesters demanded that Germany pull out from the NATO alliance. Some said the United States is benefiting from Germany's intervention in the Russia-Ukraine war. Germany is among Western countries that have provided Ukraine with a wide range of weapons since the war erupted in February 2022.
I'm mainly concerned with crisis intervention and resolving this armed conflict on the one hand. On the other hand, of course, there are trends in the militarization of Germany. After all, from a purely political point of view, Germany is right in the middle, and America is shamelessly taking advantage of that too, using citizens through media policy to perhaps ultimately use them for their own goals, and Ukrainian citizens were also exploited.
The German economy has suffered due to crisis in Ukraine. It tipped into a recession at the start of the year and stagnated in the second quarter. High inflation, industrial slowdown, and reduction in global demand for manufactured goods have all been weighing on the German economy. And earlier in October, dozens of anti-war activists in New York City said that the interest of NATO depends on the perpetuation of imperial capital and extraction of wealth from the dispossessed.
Unification of peace forces in the United States, recognizing that it's the United States and NATO who are the to blame and the fundamental cause of the conflict in Ukraine, and that if we can force the U.S. government to stop sending money and weapons to Ukraine, the war will end the very next day.
A poll conducted in August said most Americans oppose Congress authorizing additional funding. Overall, 55% say the U.S. Congress should not authorize additional funding to support Ukraine versus 45% who say Congress should authorize such funding. And 51% say that the U.S. has already done enough to help Ukraine. The removal of Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House of Representatives has added to the uncertainty around aid for Ukraine.
Kevin McCarthy has been ousted as Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives in a brutal, historic rebellion by far-right Republicans. The rebellious GOP lawmakers, furious at his cooperation with Democrats, have accused him of a string of broken promises. This is the first ouster of a Speaker in the House's 234-year history.
On this vote, the yeas are 216, the nays are 210. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table. The office of Speaker of the House of the United States House of Representatives is hereby declared vacant.
I mean, it's a sign, I think, if history is any guide at all to this, it's a sign of a party in disintegration. I mean, that's what's happening, and it's melting down, and that's pretty clear. That's the older history. The more recent history, I think, is that what we're seeing today is the latest installment in the, you know, ever continuing coup d'etat by Donald Trump. I mean, that's what we're seeing.
The vote to oust McCarthy marks a major escalation in tensions for a House GOP conference that has been mired in infighting, and it comes just days after McCarthy successfully engineered a last-minute bipartisan effort to avert a government shutdown.
that I think probably the next step would be a shutdown, which is really what they're probably aiming for. They wanted to get McCarthy out of there in part because he stood in the way of that. Bunch of reasons, but that's part of it. And it's the politics of chaos.
The effort to oust the speaker was led by GOP Republican Matt Gaetz. There is also a significant amount of distrust and anger from House Democrats towards McCarthy over his actions as speaker and the House GOP agenda. The rebellious lawmakers accused McCarthy of a flip-flop, saying he had promised an end to hastily prepared stopgap legislation hammered out with the support of the opposition and a return to budgeting through the committee process. Some Republican leaders condemned McCarthy's removal, with former vice president and current presidential candidate Mike Pence suggesting it would undermine the GOP in the eyes of voters. There is no clear successor to oversee the House Republican majority. Congress has just over 40 days to agree on a deal to avoid another potential government shutdown.
But there is a certain nihilistic quality to what they're doing. However, there is also, you know, genius in the madness, because the madness is about creating as much chaos as possible. And then, you know, then the Trump people will step in.
Speaker Kevin McCarthy's ouster could signal a shift in the U.S. House of Representatives on aid to Ukraine, with some of his possible successors staunchly opposed to assisting Kiev. Republican opponents of the aid view it as excessive spending and a misplaced U.S. policy priority.
I rise to put the leadership of the House, the Senate, and the President of the United States on notice. I will not consent to any expedited passage of any spending bill that provides any more American aid to Ukraine. It's as if no one has noticed that we have no extra money to send to Ukraine. Our deficit this year will exceed $1.5 trillion. Borrowing money from China to send it to Ukraine makes no sense. It's not as if we have some sort of rainy day fund sitting around, trillions of dollars in a pot of money, and we're just going to send that to Ukraine. We're going to borrow it. When we borrow it and create new money to pay for that borrowing, we create the inflation that is plaguing our economy.
McCarthy earlier this week denied accusations by Gaetz that he had cut a secret deal with Biden to allow the House to vote on Ukraine aid. McCarthy said then he wanted more information from the Biden administration. President Joe Biden asked Congress in July to approve another $24 billion related to Ukraine. Although the compromise struck in Congress dropped new fundings for Ukraine amid opposition from hardline Republicans, it remains unclear what might happen next. Biden and his Democratic Party say the U.S. has a duty to help Ukraine.
And why it's critically important for the United States and our allies that we keep our commitment. We can support Ukraine in the next tranche that we need, and there is another means by which we may be able to find funding for that, but I'm not going to get into that now.
However, the issue has become so politicized in Washington that the fate of vital military aid is now in jeopardy. The U.S. has approved four rounds of aid to Ukraine, totaling about $113 billion, with some of that money going towards replenishment of U.S. military equipment that was sent to the front lines.
Since the beginning of Russia's war in Ukraine, the American taxpayers provided Ukraine with $113 billion. Over the 583 days of war, between February 24, 2022 and the end of the month, that averages $6.8 billion per month, or $223 million per day. There's a lot of things that we need to fix in our country before we borrow money to try to perpetuate a war in another country.
There are also widespread concerns over corruption in Ukraine. The U.S. is increasingly urging Ukraine to do more to combat corruption. This is while Ukraine considers the direct budget support it gets from the U.S. and other foreign allies to be vital to keeping its economy afloat.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The United Kingdom's oil and gas sector regulator is drawing up plans to give companies a greater focus on decarbonisation, given that they are not on track to deliver a commitment to halving their emissions by 2030. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. United Kingdom's oil and gas companies need to do more if they're to meet an official target of halving their emissions from fossil fuel extraction by the end of the decade, according to the North Sea regulator. The North Sea Transition Authority, the NSTA, said it would set out proposals to help give fossil fuel companies a greater focus on their climate pledges, amid concerns that targets would be missed without further action. The firms promised to slash their carbon emissions caused during the production of oil and gas as part of a deal struck with the government in 2021 to secure billions of pounds in state help for the sector. This year, the British government set out plans to grant more than 100 new North Sea exploration licenses and gave the green light to develop the huge Rosebank oil field. The North Sea Transition Authority warning is the latest to cast doubt on the United Kingdom's meeting its legally binding climate targets, given government announcements of plans to delay the ban on combustion engines in new vehicles and the phase-out of gas boilers, and to water down home energy efficiency standards. The watchdog's proposals will form part of an industry consultation to encourage oil and gas operators to take action today. The industry is under pressure to reduce carbon emissions from oil and gas production, which accounts for about 3% of total United Kingdom greenhouse gas emissions. Last month, the North Sea Transition Authority report found the industry was on track to meet the interim emissions reduction targets of 10% by 2025 and 25% by 2027, compared with 2018, but added that bold measures will be required to halve carbon emissions by 2030. Significant progress has been made, but there is more work to be done, and the North Sea Transition Authority estimates that without further initiatives, the 2030 emissions reduction target agreed between the government and industry as part of the North Sea Transition Deal may be missed. The government's transition deal earmarked more than £8 billion in public funds to support the industry as it prepared to play a role in the United Kingdom's ambition to develop carbon capture technology and hydrogen production. In exchange, the industry promised to cut its carbon emissions and use British-made components for 50% of their decarbonisation projects. The North Sea Transition Authority said the industry risked losing its ongoing social licence to operate, which allowed companies to keep drilling for oil and gas even while Britain moved away from fossil fuels, unless it could meet its longer-term climate targets. Philip Evans, a climate campaigner for Greenpeace UK, said the industry's operational emissions were the mere tip of the iceberg compared with those produced by using fossil fuels, which accounted for more than 80% of the total emissions from drilling, extracting and burning oil and gas. This is why Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's plan to max out North Sea reserves is a grave mistake, Philip Evans said. The government's deliberate disregard for the majority of the emissions from these climate-wrecking projects is completely reckless, and the reason we're fighting them in two separate courts of law. And unless it revokes the recently approved license for Rosebank, we're likely to be back for a third court case. A British government spokesperson said, through our landmark North Sea transition deal agreed between the British government and industry, we are backing the decarbonisation of the oil and gas sector while supporting tens of thousands of jobs across Scotland and the wider United Kingdom. While our plans to power up Britain include significant investment in new renewable and nuclear projects, the transition to non-fossil forms of energy cannot happen overnight. And even when we're at net zero emissions, we still need some oil and gas, as recognised by the Independent Climate Change Committee. The business media brand, the ED Network and the ED website has also covered the same story and tells us more. The North Sea Transition Authority this week opened a consultation on a forthcoming plan for low-carbon transition for the sector. It has concluded that the industry is on track to reduce carbon emissions by 10% by 2025 and by 25% by 2027. Against the 2018 baseline. However, measures already in train across the sector are unlikely to deliver a promise to halve carbon emissions between 2018 and 2030. By the North Sea Transition Authority's calculations, significant progress has been made, but there is more work to be done. And the North Sea Transition Authority estimates that without further initiatives, the 2030 emissions reduction target agreed between the government and industry as part of the North Sea Transition Deal may be missed. The statement by the North Sea Transition Authority added, "Bold measures will be needed to deliver the 2030 climate target. Progress is tough and will require investment, collaborative effort, and detailed planning." The North Sea Transition Authority is consulting on measures to reduce the sector's operational emissions across four pillars: energy and material efficiency, switching fuel sources to electric or other low-carbon alternatives, cutting venting and flaring, and managing asset inventory to phase out older, less efficient assets. It bears noting that Scope 3, or indirect emissions from the sector, are not covered in the North Sea Transition Authority's proposed plan. As the bulk of the sector's total carbon footprint is generated from the end use of its fuels, Greenpeace UK has stated that the proposed changes would only address the mere tip of the iceberg. On flaring and venting, Chris Skidmore, MP's Net Zero Review, recommended the implementation of a ban in 2025. The British government declined to adopt this recommendation and said the original 2030 ban date would already be challenging to meet. The North Sea Transition Authority is consulting on interim targets to reduce venting and flaring, creating a more detailed pathway. Already, flaring has been reduced by more than 40% since 2018. In other news from the North Sea's fossil fuel sector, the Crown State has awarded a BP-led carbon capture and storage project with an agreement for lease. The Crown State has stated that the project, called Endurance, has the potential to be one of the largest of its kind in the world. It will enable carbon dioxide to be stored in a reservoir in a rock deep under the ocean. Carbon being stored in the reservoir would predominantly be captured from heavy industrial clusters in the northeast. British Petroleum BP is notably leading the East Coast Cluster project to bring industrial hubs in Humberside and in Teesside to net zero by 2050. Other firms are participating through the Northern Endurance Partnership. The Crown State, which leases plots of seabed, called the awarding of the lease agreement a significant milestone for growing Britain's carbon capture and storage capacity.
U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
Part 4.
In any country, the judicial system is assigned with fighting corruption. With the start of the Reconstruction period, the Americans promised Afghans that they would establish an efficient judicial system. Eric Holder, the then U.S. Attorney General, talked about the rule of law, complete transparency, and enjoying maximum justice in Afghanistan.
Now, the United States is committed to partnering with Afghanistan to ensure that all Afghan citizens have access to a fair, efficient, and transparent judicial system.
But by the end of U.S. presence in Afghanistan, the indices for justice and the rule of law were in the worst condition. Reports released by the World Justice Project in 2019 and 2020 confirm it. As for the rule of law, Afghanistan ranked 122nd among 128 countries, and as for regulatory enforcement, it was among the 10 worst countries. Finally, in civil justice, it was ranked 123rd among 128 countries. Apart from international reports, the people of Afghanistan were completely dissatisfied with their judicial system introduced by the U.S. According to the report by World Justice Project, the people had the highest degree of distrust in the Afghan judges. That's why most of the people felt like the formal judicial system could not ensure justice, so they prefer the informal judicial system, a network that was traditionally in place to resolve disputes within Afghan society.
In 2016, we conducted a study that aimed at looking at what these perceptions and experiences were like. And we saw that a large number of Afghans were pursuing these informal mechanisms.
Based on the World Justice Project's report, the first thing that came to mind when people regarded the courthouses of Afghanistan was corruption. After the fundamental problems of the Afghan judicial system, the International Court of Justice at The Hague considered the Afghan judicial system completely collapsed because of its absolute inefficiency.
And I'll stop there for a moment. What we do have in Afghanistan is a substantial collapse or unavailability of the national system.
Corruption in the Afghan judicial system was part of the organized corruption within the system caused by the U.S. during the Reconstruction period. The courthouses, the police, and the administrative employees were all part of it.
They wanted a little bit of justice, the Afghan people. So what do? We build courthouses. We hire corrupt judges, corrupt prosecutors, and corrupt officials.
The dark and non-transparent atmosphere in Afghanistan was the best chance for U.S. companies to possess a big chunk of the Reconstruction budget. Fox News calls it windfalls of war for the companies. As John Sopko put it, the companies found out the odor of mendacity was coming from Afghanistan.
But there's an odor of mendacity throughout the Afghanistan issue.
Under those circumstances, so much was stolen from the Afghan Reconstruction Fund that John Sopko doesn't exactly know how many billions of dollars was actually stolen.
I can tell you it's in the billions. And I can also tell you it's too much. We've wasted too much. How much has been stolen? I just don't have the time to track that down. It's almost impossible. I know the Wartime Contracting Commission, which was set up by Congress and looked at Iraq and Afghanistan, I'm trying to think, it was a 60, 70 billion they came up. But I don't know where they came up with that number.
The American companies were behind the stealing.
because neither Afghan politicians nor people had the access to the Reconstruction Fund. No court session was held in the U.S. or anywhere else to deal with the stealing or the corruption in the Reconstruction process, except for one court session that was held in Afghanistan in 2014 to handle the case of corruption in Reconstruction. The court charged an Afghan. The interesting point is an American testified against him. Eventually, corruption put an end to the 20-year reconstruction. The corruption had its roots in the U.S. Assuming the Afghan reconstruction failed, a question comes to mind. Why did the U.S. government spend money for reconstruction of a poor and war-stricken country like Afghanistan in the first place? In 2019, Afghanistan was the biggest recipient of U.S. foreign aid.
The United States is the world's largest giver in the world, by far, of foreign aid.
In 2020, Afghanistan was a top recipient of U.S. non-military aid. But what was the U.S. after? Humanitarian goals, or was it pursuing another goal? U.S. reconstruction projects are basically in line with an old policy: foreign assistance. Foreign assistance is a strategic tool along the U.S. military and diplomatic forces.
If you look at our foreign assistance as a tool in our national security portfolio, as opposed to charity, then you combined our defense budget overall with our diplomatic budget and our foreign assistance budget, then in that mix, there's a lot more we should be doing.
On the other hand, in order to use the natural resources of a poor country, the U.S. needs to enter that country as a charitable country.
Oftentimes not focused exclusively on poverty alleviation. In fact, it was used to try to forge political alliances and to try to buy access to a country's natural resources.
The goal of accessing natural resources in Afghanistan was defined as striking a balance between reconstruction and the energy resources and mines in the country.
There were a lot of multilateral assessments that were going on at the time that would ultimately drive some of the strategies for the mining and energy sector. When I first stepped foot into Afghanistan, I realized that there are so many projects. One of the best ways to approach our aid would be to regionalize our aid, and we should have reconstituted them. I always say this wasn't a reconstruction effort. This was a construction effort. And we came in thinking, oh, we'll just go to the region and put some money in there, and it'll be back on its feet.
In order to ameliorate and wipe off the military invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. used foreign assistance as a tool to pursue its political and economic agendas.
It is in America's interest to do the things that we do with foreign assistance. It is in our economic interest. It is in our security interest.
Eventually, the measures turned the country that received support into a consumer of American goods and a political ally of the United States. This is a policy the U.S. implemented after World War II in many European countries, including Germany and Asian countries like Japan and South Korea. The European and Asian countries were economically developed, but at a big cost, and that was their military and political independence was taken away from them.
We've had troops in Europe now for 70 years.
Yeah.
We've had troops in South Korea for 70 years.
The program was supposed to be implemented in the second wave of reconstruction in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, but the past experience did not happen again for the U.S.
We haven't learned the lessons of Vietnam. If anything, after Vietnam, we said we're never going to do it, and we cut all of the capabilities to do these type of reconstruction events or activities in a war zone. And lo and behold, we said we're never going to do it again. We did it in Iraq. We did it in Afghanistan.
The U.S. failures in Vietnam and Afghanistan were not similar only in the exit from the embassies, but failure in reconstruction was another factor that Vietnam and Afghanistan had in common. After the reconstruction failure in Afghanistan, the permanent SIGAR organization also came to an end, and Afghan reconstruction case was closed.
I've spent a lot of time over the last number of weeks, and my staff has, trying to get our American SIGAR employees out.
But the U.S. State Department did not allow the last reports on Afghanistan to be published and barred the public from accessing the reconstruction documents.
SIGAR was forced to relegate all of this information into classified annexes.
So, John Supko, head of the Investigating Institute, was forced to classify the documents.
Shortly after the fall of Kabul, the State Department wrote to me and other oversight agencies requesting that we, quote unquote, temporarily suspend access to all of our audit, inspection, and financial reports.
Classifying documents apparently means everything is over and no one should know what happened in reconstruction of Afghanistan.
So the Afghan people really preferred the Taliban sometimes to the officials that we brought in from the central government.
Why?
That was a serious problem. But to the Afghan people, they actually got justice from the Taliban. So you didn't have to offer, you didn't have to reinvent the wheel, you didn't have to do major programs in these districts to win the hearts and minds of the Afghan people.
The Americans might be able to shred all the realities on papers and demolish them or burn them. They might be able to remove the data from any network or system, and they might be able to secretly take the classified documents out of Afghanistan, but the realities on the ground cannot be shredded or burned and cannot remain classified forever. The realities will one day reveal what happened under the skin of Afghanistan.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.